Thanks very much indeed, David. It's always a great pleasure to do things at the Foundation. It's a particular pleasure to do it on the day we remember John Selborne. I got to know John when I had the privilege of being on the Board of Trustees of Kew under John, and what little skill I have as a chair these days, I learnt at John's feet. And I also interacted with John and with Joanna when I chaired for the Royal Society, the Southeast Asian Rainforest Research Programme. And John and Joanna visited the programme a few years back and astounded the local Malaysian guides and things by their fitness and ability to climb in tropical weathers up very steep, muddy slopes. So it's lovely to see John's family here. It's always a problem coming last. I started with a 10-minute talk. I've got about 2 minutes left once all the important things have been said. I share a lot of Dieter's concern right at the beginning. And I do encourage you to read Dieter's blog, where he, which he published recently, where he takes some of these ideas and extends them. And his point about the relentless 2 parts per million drumbeat of increasing carbon dioxide going in the atmosphere is really important. Of course, we don't know what it would be in the absence of the COP process. It could be worse, but it's a very sobering fact. But in the sort of dichotomy between the first two speakers and the second two speakers, I'm going to try and put some of the cases for the defense, sort of being on the same side with Barbara, and try and be positive about some things that have come out of COP. And I think we should also realize that if you go back a year ago, there were a number of people, me included, in the community who were really worried about the whole process of COP and that the UK, whether the UK could pull it off. And I think it's a credit for Alok Sharma, Peter Hill, and their team that it had the limited success that it did. It certainly wasn't a car crash. So Barbara's already mentioned some of what I think are the positive things that came out, some of which are quite nerdy, the sort of improvement on the Paris rule book, an increasingly large number of countries committing to NDCs. One hopes India will go much better, but the mere fact that they've set NDCs, and Dieter's right, 50 years is a long way ahead, but hopefully now that it's there, it can be ratcheted up in the future. And the fact that it's now written into the final communique and things that we do need a 45% reduction in greenhouse gases by 2030, and that we really need to reaffirm what Paris said about 1.5, I think it's good. I think that there is positive movements on trying to get carbon markets to work, not completely positive, but going in the right direction. I would reiterate something that Dieter said about the importance about putting a price on carbon and doing carbon border adjustments. There's been interesting progress in the European community over the last 6 months, 9 months on that. Again, you could wish for it to be faster, but you can imagine a good direction of change there. And I very much hope that we in the UK align with that and that we don't have a sort of Brexit huff about a really good initiative that is coming out of Europe. But of course, against that positive side, one can see a number of negatives, the glacial progress on funding. Both Barbara and Dieter mentioned, we should be transferring $100 billion from the rich to the poor world to help for mitigation and adaptation. And that's just not happening. And I think looking ahead to COP27, to Sharm el-Sheikh, this sort of geographic equity is going to be such an important issue there. We have the complex issue of the loss and damage fund, which was discussed, but not very much at Glasgow. And I follow two Scottish speakers, and I would point out that the only two countries that have actually made a positive contribution to the loss and damage fund is Scotland and Wallonia, which is an interesting pairing. Just while we're on this national thing, there are a variety of consortia of the willing, including Beyond Oil and Gas, that Wales signed up for, but not Scotland in that case. And what also worries me are the geopolitical headwinds. We can see that the China engaged in COP26, but not as much as one would have hoped. Yes, it was great that there was a China-US joint statement and joint agreement, but I think even as experienced a diplomat as Kerry rather hoped that China would be able to set aside climate change and discuss with America, discuss with other countries, separate from all the other things that China is concerned about. And I don't think that came about. And that's a chastening bit of political reality there. I want to mention a couple of the initiatives that came out on the sides of COP. The alliance that Mark Carney got together, 400 companies, financial institutions to align to net zero is good. Those companies are responsible for $130 trillion of assets under management. Now, if that is genuinely aligned to net zero, that will make a difference. I think there is a real air of change in the private sector about wanting to move in this direction. Certainly not uniformly. Certainly there's a lot of greenwashing about. But I think if one casts one's mind back even 5 or 10 years ago, the direction of progress is really positive. For example, the number of companies that are engaging in science-based targets and setting net zero. As Barbara said, the initiatives on forests is good. And yes, we've been there before in 2014, but more countries are involved. There is some real money going in there. Forests are complex, and Barbara's right that it lacks the legal enforceability of the main COP process. But there's enormous progress that has been made in our ability to monitor deforestation in real time, which I think is hopeful, encouraging. And 75% of avoided emissions from forestry occur in just three countries, Brazil, Congo, and Indonesia. So by concentrating on those three countries, which makes it, all of those three countries have their own great challenges, but at least one can get a lot of traction just by engaging with a limited number of countries. And it was good that the UK put in an investment of 500 million towards protecting forests. Yes, it's great on methane to have a commitment of a 30% reduction by 2030, but we actually need 45%. Again, as I think Barbara said, China, Russia, and India were not amongst them. And if you look into the weeds of what the methane declaration is, there is a lot of really good stuff on the technological innovations that one might have in order to reduce methane from gas pipelines, to reduce it from livestock. But it is a shame that they shy away from some of the difficult things, including diet change, that we will just have to have if we have any hope of reducing methane. And methane, because it's a short-lived gas, can make a real difference. Methane is going to be essential if we have any hope of keeping before 1.5. I'm particularly interested in food. I think there's been food has been rather outside the COP processes over the years. I think that it was more central to this COP than previous COPs. There were a series of announcements from the UK, which are modest, but I think really exciting. £25 million going into the CG system, this wonderful system of international laboratories responsible for the Green Revolution and have been starved of funds over the last 10 years. There's the US-UAE initiative, the Agricultural Innovation Mission for Climate, which has now attracted £4 billion. We desperately need more research and investment going into agriculture and to a modern type of agricultural research, which seeks not just to increase yields, but to increase sustainability there. So I think there were a suite of interesting innovations coming out there. I like the fact that nature and and climate are now more closely linked together. I think it's great that the UK is committing £40 million for a global centre on biodiversity and climate. But then looking on the other side, this is all great, but Ian's exactly right. It is easy to make these commitments and excitements and boosterism on the supply side, but we're shying away from some of the hard issues, again, when it comes to food and diet, on diets, and then the political hard issues. Completely agree with Barbara on what she said about how we sign trade agreements. And the pervasive subsidies, which we all know about in the energy sector, but are almost as pervasive in the food sector and are acting against sustainability. And I'm going to finish up by, I can't quite match Barbara's 6 points for what the UK might do. And I'm going to concentrate on one, which partially overlaps with one of the things that she says, that she pointed out. The government has made a series of really quite interesting commitments on biodiversity, on net zero, on what they want from our rural economies. And I'm concerned that these don't quite add up together, or they might add up, but it's going to be harder to get them to add up. So exactly as Barbara says, we need to have a land use framework in order that we can try and titrate these different commitments and just see whether we can make them. Whatever you thought about Brexit, we're out of the European community, and we can do different things with the money we used to put into our rural economy through the CAP. And I think that DEFRA, during the time when Ian was chief scientific advisor there, in a document rather curiously called Health and Harmony, came up with, in my view, what was probably the most interesting document to have come out of an environment and farming ministry since the last war. And this was a commitment to net zero. And I think the commitment to net zero and the possibility of completely reformulating the way we support our rural economy to produce a multitude of public goods as well as private goods. And public goods, they're really in the economist definition of public goods. It is wrong, as you hear politicians say, well, food is a public good. Food is good for the public. It's not technically a public good. And I think until we get that right, it's going to be very hard for us to talk to other countries and lecture other countries. We really do have an opportunity to do something that has major effects for both climate and for biodiversity. And Barbara mentioned it, and every farmer or farming organization that I talk to say, well, tell us what is going to happen. And exactly in the same way as the Bank of England will now give forward guidance about interest rate policies in the future, we're crying out for forward guidance about exactly how public money for public goods is going to work its way through to the system. So forgive me for repeating many of the very good points the previous speakers have said. Thanks very much indeed.